I'd like to welcome Dennis to come up here and speak for us tonight.
All right.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to thank Billy for inviting me to come, because in my later days of drinking, I wasn't invited to go to many places at all. And also, you've been so kind, I almost feel like a celebrity standing up here the way I've been treated. As was introduced, my name is Dennis, and I am an alcoholic. I have a sponsor. I do sponsor a person, and today is really a very significant day for me. It is the 22nd of December, and it marks 8 years and 7 months of sobriety for me, because my sobriety date is May 22nd, 2011. I would like to start off by giving a little bit of history of my history as a child and so forth, family history, because I think once I explain to you how I got the name Dennis, you may have a little bit better insight as to why it was very probable that I would possibly become an alcoholic. When my parents were married in 1940, and during that time, young men either went into the service or did something to help in the war effort, in which case my father worked at the Newport News Shipbuilding Company. And, of course, my mother had grown up on a farm and wasn't used to being away from home. Anyway, so that was a new environment for her. During that time, my mother began to hear voices and have hallucinations and so forth, and my father took her to a doctor in Williamsburg, and she was experiencing schizophrenia. But at that time, they wanted to put her in the hospital in Williamsburg. When my father got her there around 5 o'clock, they had closed for the evening and would not take her. And in the meantime, my mother convinced my father to take her to her home physician in Farmville, which is not too far away. And so her physician in Farmville discovered that she was having a hormonal imbalance because she was pregnant. So he said, once the child is born, this imbalance in the hormones that's causing this schizophrenia will probably just pass. Well, you know, back in those days, they didn't know a whole lot about mental illness. They certainly did not. So my brother was born in 1944, and her condition did not improve. So then the family doctor said, well, if you have another child, then that will counteract all of what has happened with the first child. The hormones will get, kind of get straightened out. So then I came along. And at this time, the only place where they treated people with mental illness and pregnancy and so forth was the University of Virginia. So in 1945, I came along. And my father wanted to name me Patricia. My mother had a cousin. She was very fond of this cousin and wanted to name a child Dennis after this cousin. Well, the doctors at UVA told my parents that she absolutely could not have any more children. So they knew I was the last child. They knew I was going to be it because the doctors tied my mother's fallopian tubes, and that was it. So they decided to name me Dennis Evelyn, so that my mother would at least have a child named after her favorite cousin, and that's how I got the name. But during the years that followed that, of course, my mother never did get better. She would go in the hospital for 3 or 4 months, come home for 2 or 3 months, then have to go back. So as a young child, I spent several months with my paternal aunt, My brother stayed with my maternal grandfather, so I was kind of living with relatives, at, you know, while my mother was away and so forth. And of course, it was a traumatic childhood for me because when my mother did come home, she could be very cruel. And it was, it made things very dysfunctional. And of course, I was very afraid of my mother. I grew up with a lot of fear there, and as a result of that, I was extremely close to my brother. My brother and I were like that. We looked after each other. And of course, I grew up as a tomboy because everywhere my brother went, I went. And most of all the children on my street were boys, so I basically grew up as a tomboy. But it made my brother and I extremely close. In elementary school, I knew my mother was different. I could see other parents. I knew there was a big difference. And kids, you know, can be very cruel in elementary school. Kids used to say, her mother's crazy. And, you know, and it was very hurtful. And at an early age, I already began to feel less than. I began to feel very different. I began to feel probably experienced very low self-esteem and so forth. And then on into junior high school, I was beginning to exhibit attention-seeking behavior in school. I was always getting in trouble, talking out of turn. My grades were not the best. And so I was just not doing very well. And then in the ninth grade, one thing that really changed for me was I had been getting D's, mostly D's in school, and not doing very well at all. But during holidays, we always had the high school band come through our hometown and play, have the little march during the 4th of July, Christmas parades, and that I was always excited with that. So when I was in the ninth grade, I wanted to be in the band. And, of course, I asked my dad, first thing I wanted to do was play the drum. The band director wouldn't let me do that. Then I wanted the sousaphone. He said, no, I won't let girls do that. But I did ask to play the saxophone. Now, I had to beg my daddy to rent a saxophone for me because he said it'd be like everything else. You'll get this, you'll start playing it, then you'll put it down, and then I'll be out of all that money and so forth. But I begged and pleaded, please, if you get me that saxophone, I promise I'll practice every night. Well, I did. When he got me the saxophone, I loved it, and I excelled in it. I loved it, and I excelled. You know, they say nothing succeeds like success. So my grades started becoming, instead of D's, they started becoming A's and B's, and because I found something I really loved. Now, at this time, when I was like 11 and 12, I begged my daddy to divorce my mother so he could remarry and I'd have a normal mother. But my father was a very moral person, and he told me, he said, I married your mother for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, and you have to just understand that your mother is sick. And so, and that was that. That was it. And so, and I continued on. When I was in the eighth grade, my mother went into the hospital again, and my father decided then that, you know, she was not going to be able to come back home until the doctors could assure him that she was totally well. Well, that never happened. It never happened. She was in Western State, Eastern State, Central State, and so forth, and eventually passed away while she was in one of those institutions, but I'll get to that later. Okay, so I started doing better. Now, my family was not a drinking family. I did not grow up in a family where alcohol was an issue. My father did not drink. I think my mother may have gotten into some wine one Christmas or something, and that just made her start singing. I mean, it wasn't your typical drug, that's for sure. So anyway, but my grades got better, but and I decided I wanted to pursue music as a career because it was something I truly, truly loved. And so I worked very hard, and I was able to get into college. But there again, this feeling of inadequacy made me what I call an overachiever. I didn't feel like I was very smart. I had such a tremendous fear of failure that I would just work very, very hard to succeed. And I did well in school from that point on. And I did well in college. And but again, like I said, I worked very, very hard. Well, during my senior year, I met a young man, and we dated, and of course I graduated and started teaching, and 2 years later we were married. And so still, up to this point, I was not involved with alcohol. I may have gone to one or two Christmas parties where maybe I had a bourbon, but it was nothing significant at all. But after I was married, we moved to a town down on the Rappahannock River. And we built a home, and it was a new community where people were coming in. And this was back in the early 70s. And my drinking really started as social drinking. And the neighbors next door, would invite us over for cocktails on Friday night. Well, we went over, and we were new in the neighborhood. Then the neighbors would invite us maybe again. Then we felt like, well, we need to reciprocate. We need to have them over. So we started inviting them over. So then Friday night became Friday, Saturday night. Then it became Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Then these neighbors down here. And there was a lot of drinking in the neighborhood. And back in those days, advertising had a tremendous effect. It was very powerful. It had a tremendous effect on people's thinking. You'd go down the road and see these big billboards with someone holding a drink in their hand, and they'd have up there with that old Forester or whatever. And it just printed the impression of success. When you saw that picture and you're standing there holding that drink, you felt like you had arrived. You felt like you were somebody. I mean, and advertising was very powerful. But as the drinking began to continue, it got so then, well, let's have a little drink before dinner. Now, then one drink becomes two. You know how it goes. Then two become three. Then pretty soon it's four and five. Then pretty soon you're having cocktails every night. Well, anyway, during that time, I won't go into a lot of that, but it was during that time of drinking, as my drinking escalated, I made some bad decisions. I made some very bad decisions. Anyway, I ended up in a divorce, and so I ended up moving to Richmond. Well, when I moved to Richmond, I got an apartment, and then after about 4 months of living in that apartment, I decided I wanted to buy a condo because I felt like I was just putting money into a place and not getting any value in return. So I bought a little condo. Well, my condo, I bought it in March. Well, by April and May, it was beginning to get springtime, and this place had a pool, and it was next to a park, next to a beautiful park. Then it had this big, nice swimming pool, and I had this nice little balcony, and all of a sudden, I was by myself. I had friends. I had a lot of friends at this time. And I could go over to the pool in the summer and then come back and sit on my little balcony and have my drinks. And nobody to sit there and tell me you've had too much to drink or don't you think you better stop. So I had no one around to monitor the drinks. At least when I was married, my husband would say, I think you better cut that off. You know, it's getting a little out of hand. But anyway, but the booze began to become a much more important part of my life. And when I was there in that condo, especially in the summertime, and not having to get up and go to school, I really did do some partying, and I would get with friends, and we would just drink. Then it got to where, well, let's go over to the pool, let's make a big old jug full and take it over to the pool. And I know there were times when people, I would be, you know, kind of wobbling around out there. But anyway, that my drinking really took off there. But then when the fall would come, I would always somehow be able to manage my drinking at night. I would say, okay, I'm just going to have enough because I knew I had to get up and go to school the next day. So, and that went on, and I was able to pretty much function. I was a functional drinker when I was in school because what I ended up doing was I followed my dream, I followed my passion, and I was a middle school band director. So, and it was something I really loved doing. But there were times when I, later in drinking, when I would go to school, and I know I was feeling pretty rough, but I was able to hold it all together. And then I retired. After I got in enough time, I retired. And, of course, by this time, my drinking had also escalated. And by this time, also, I had friends who were telling me, Dennis, you have a problem. You need to get some help. And so, and I was in denial, but I knew I was drinking too much, but I loved the effect of alcohol. I mean, and I was at the point where I would read these little things in the Parade magazine, and it was, you'd have 10 little questions, and it would say, if you answered yes to 3 or more, you're probably an alcoholic. And I could answer yes to about 8 of them. So I knew. But I still would not say I was an alcoholic. But it was after I retired, I built some friendships with people over in Chesterfield County. And these were big, big-time party people. And these people had a place down on the river. And on the weekends, we'd all get together, and we'd go down to the river house. And of course, a lot of my time was spent out on the river, boating, skiing, and so forth. But these people were big, big party people. And we would get out on the river, and we would start drinking. On the way down, we would drink constantly from Friday all day, Saturday, Sunday, and we just stayed drunk. We just stayed absolutely drunk. And, of course, a lot of things went on down there. I mean, I will say this. There were times when I did things that I would never have done had I been sober. It's like some people laugh at it, but I remember one time I woke up and I was in the bed with a man and a woman, and I was the only one naked. And it was, so, I mean, this was hard partying. But that's when my drinking really, really took off. And of course, by this time, I was having blackout drinking and not remembering. And even before this, my friends would say, Dennis, do you remember the conversation we had last night? And I would not remember. And I'd say, yeah, I kind of remember. And they'd say, well, and then when we'd go to discuss it, I couldn't discuss a thing. My friends could tell, but when I got on the phone, just how intoxicated I was. And I want to back up just a little bit and I'll mention this. I did not mention it at the time, but when I was in college, my brother had gone and joined the Army, and he was sent to Vietnam. And when I was a junior in college, he was killed in Vietnam. And that was a very, very sad time for me. It was a devastating blow because we were so very close. Then a year later, just before in April before I graduated from college, my father died. And I know it was from a broken heart. About 5 years later, my mother passed away. So I lost my immediate family all within a very short period of time. But when I would get to drinking, I would get on the phone and I would call people and I'd start crying about you know, I would cry about losing my brother. I couldn't understand. I just hate the fact that they had to go over there to Vietnam in the first place. And I would just be crying over that. And I know what it was. It was what we call unhealed hurts. I mean, I had grieved a lot, but it was still, that was the greatest loss of my life, was losing my brother. And I had not, I guess, dealt with it as well as I could have up to that point. And I think when I would drink, drinking brought that up. It didn't necessarily drown it away. It more than anything, it brought it up in me. And so, anyway, but that's what I wanted to say, that when I was drinking, I'd get on the phone and call people and be crying. I was one of those weepy, crying drunks. You know, some people are happy drunks. I was a weepy, crying drunk, or one that didn't know the meaning of the word no. I didn't, when I was drinking, you could get me to do anything. I mean, I just didn't know what no was. I didn't have any sense. I lost all judgment when I was drinking, if I'd had enough. And the thing that is, I loved the effect of alcohol. When I started drinking, that little buzz, I'd say, oh, that's a nice little buzz, that little euphoric feeling. And I would want to just kind of chase it along. Oh, that feels so good. A little more. And then pretty soon, I've fallen off the cliff. I'm just totally intoxicated. Then I don't remember anything. And, of course, I don't need to tell you about the times you fall down, you wake up, you wonder how you bruised your arm, you wonder why you got a cut on your face, and you just don't remember this stuff. But or you wake up and you're wondering why you're in the floor and it's 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, I mean, I can laugh at this now, but it was not funny. When I at down at the river, I was coming back from the river one, I think it was a Monday night, and I was weaving, and someone called in. Anyway, I got pulled over. I got a DUI. Of course, they threw me in jail. This was down in Middlesex County, and I had to go see the magistrate, and they did all that. It was, and they treated me like I was the worst criminal on the face of this earth. Well, do you think that getting a DUI and being thrown in jail would stop me from drinking? No. You know what I did? I went to a golf course. But at that time, I was playing golf, and I said, I'd like to be a starter here. And if you would, you know, take the golf carts and wash them off and park them, you could be a starter and, you know, do all that and get to play free golf. Well, I wanted that, because it would enable me to drive, because when I got the DUI, I went to see a lawyer because I knew I was in trouble. I was in big trouble. So I got a lawyer to try to, you know, represent me, and he got me what you call a restricted license. So he said, now you can go to work. So at that time, I'd retired, but I was still substitute teaching, so I could go to school. Then I thought, well, what else could I do? So I decided, well, let me go and volunteer at a hospital. And I volunteered at a hospital, because I knew on my way to and from the hospital, I could drive. And these people wrote to the lawyer, sent a letter stating that, you know, I had a position there. So anyway, I used the hospital job. See, I was being very manipulative. How am I going to be able to drive and get by the booze store? So I used the hospital job and the golf job to be able to drive. Well, I passed a booze store on the way to the golf store. I passed a booze store on the way from the hospital and then on the way to and from school. So I still had constant access to booze, and I kept drinking, even after being put in jail and after paying that lawyer all that money. Up to this time, I even went to see a therapist, and I just could not stop drinking. And so, anyway, I think it was 2010, I was drinking, and I knew I was in trouble, and I even had friends convince me to go to AA. So I went to AA. I started in 2005 actually going to AA, and I thought, well, if I go to AA, it's going to cure me. I thought there was something magic about it, so I started going. I went to AA meetings and nothing happened. I just went to meetings and I thought, when's it going to happen? When's it going to happen? And nothing happened. But and I would leave AA meetings and go buy booze. I mean, when I look at it, it was totally insane. It was just totally insane. And I was totally out of control. And so anyway, I started AA in 2005 and danced around the program, just danced around it. I would not get a sponsor because deep down inside, I really didn't want to give up drinking. And yet I would get up in the morning feeling so bad and I would pray, dear God, please don't let me drink tonight. Please, dear God, don't let me drink tonight. And I would get to about 3 or 4 o'clock, I'm feeling a little better. So I'm thinking, so around 5 o'clock, I'm feeling lonely. So I think, well, let me just have one drink. So I would have one drink. Well, that loneliness all of a sudden left. And by this time, then I'd have 2 drinks. And all of a sudden, I wasn't lonely anymore. And I did not want anybody calling me. And I did not want anybody coming to see me. I did not want anybody to interfere with my drinking. So I began isolating. And I would just stay in and drink, you know. And so anyway, I did a lot of isolating. And I just danced around the AA program for several years. Well, in 2010, it was one night, I knew I was in trouble. I knew I had been drinking to the point that I called several people and said, I need help. Well, finally, a dear friend came, and I thought, she's going to take me somewhere. And I was thinking about one of these luxurious places like Dr. Phil talks about, like the Oasis. Because this girl lives in a very beautiful place and has a pool and all this. And so I thought, I was on the phone with a friend in Maine packing my suitcase, because I knew they were going to take me somewhere. And I'm on the phone and I'm saying, well, I need to take a pair of jeans. I need to got to take a bathing suit. I better take 2. I packed 2 bathing suits. Anyway, I got my suitcase back. They came and the lady came with her husband, Dish's dear friend. And, of course, they took me to Tucker's. I don't know if you know where Tucker's is. And so, anyway, and of course, my alcohol content was pretty high, but I stayed there 4 days in detox. And when I left Tucker's, this was in 2010, they carried me, put me in a cab and carried me straight to an IOP. And so, and then I had to call this same friend to come and get me at the IOP and take me home. So anyway, so the IOP was very good for me because it was 8 weeks of intensive outpatient work, and I was going to meetings, and I was really trying. I was really trying to give up the booze, and it gave me 3 hours, 3 nights a week, to be concentrating on why I was drinking and so forth. IOP was very intense, but more importantly, it gave me something to do at that time that I was normally drinking, because my drinking always started at night, and of course it progressed to where it was, you pass out, you wake up 3 o'clock, drink a little more, pass out, wake up 6 o'clock, drink again. It was that bad. So I went through the IOP and I stayed sober for probably a couple of months, but then I had a relapse. I just could not stay sober. But there again, I'm going to meetings, but I'm not getting a sponsor. I'm not really doing this program. It was later in 2010, I'd been drinking, and at 9:30 in the morning, there was a knock at my door. And I went to the door, and there stood my aunt and a person I didn't know and 2 of my very dear friends. And I had just finished drinking a 24-ounce beer, and I know I smelled like a brewery. And so, anyway, they came in, sat down, and talked to me about going away to treatment. Well, I agreed to go. So It was the very next day. A friend came and stayed with me, and I went to treatment the next day. I stayed for 17 days, and my insurance ran out, so they put me on a Greyhound bus and sent me home. And so a friend met me there, and I did okay for a while. I stayed sober for a while, but then again, after a couple of months, I relapsed again. And this went on, and then in 2011, I had been drinking, and a friend came over, and a dear, dear friend, and said, "Dennis, we need to take a ride." And I knew what she said. She said, "You know what we're going to do?" And I said, "You're going to take me to the hospital?" She said, "Yes, you need to go." So she took me to St. Mary's. Well, I was there. But when they took me to St. Mary's, and I'm going to tell you this because it'll explain just how powerful and baffling this disease is. When my friend, there were two of them, took me to St. Mary's, I knew I had a bottle of wine in the back of my car. I also knew I had five of those little mini scotches in my refrigerator, which I didn't mention. I didn't mention that. So they took me on to the hospital. Of course, I'm in the hospital, and I told them, I said, "Well, before you take me, let me pour one last drink." And I filled a glass with about that much scotch. And of course, when I got to the hospital, my alcohol content was way, way up there. I mean, way up. And so anyway, but I went through, stayed in the hospital. I think it was 4 days. But the whole time I was there, I was going to those little AA meetings they brought in the hospital, but I was obsessing about that bottle of wine and those minis. And of course, they wanted me, I kept telling them, I said, "I need something for depression. I think the reason I'm drinking is because I'm depressed." Well, anyway, and they really did not want me to let me out of the hospital at the time, but I convinced them to do so. So they let me out, I'm trying to think how I got home, but I called somebody. I got home anyway. But the first thing I did when I got home, after having been in the hospital, and I drank that whole bottle of wine. I went to my car, got the whole bottle of wine, and I drank all five of those minis. And, of course, I went to just fell in the bed. And I woke up the next morning, and I thought to myself, you know, This was the moment when I realized I was powerless. See, I had been struggling all along with this thing of powerless. I knew all along that I was an alcoholic. There was no doubt in my mind. I was absolutely positive I was an alcoholic, but I could not stop, okay? But I did not and had not yet conceded to the fact that I was absolutely powerless. And you know, it says in that first step up there, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. I guess I thought I could handle it and kept trying to control it, and I couldn't control it. It had control of me. Well, when I realized that I had put those five scotches, that whole bottle of wine, on top of all that medication that they had given me when I was in the hospital. You know, when you go in to get detox, they give you medicine to help you sleep. They give you medicine to keep you from going into DTs and so forth. So they load you with a lot of medicine. And then when you start mixing alcohol, I was smart enough to know, when you start mixing these kind of drugs with alcohol, it is a deadly combination. And I knew I was powerless. So that was a turning point for me. And on May the 22nd of 2011, I went to a meeting. It was a noon meeting, and I heard this lady talk about that drinking of alcohol was but a symptom of something much deeper in our personality. And she talked about the program and being committed and diligent. Now, when I had gotten back from my treatment, I shared at a meeting, and a lady came up and asked me, do you have a sponsor? And I said, no. And she said, well, I'd like to be your sponsor. So she worked with me, but I never could get beyond step one. I wanted to do the steps, but she said, you're not ready to go to step two because you, and I was, she said, you do not yet realize that you are powerless. You're still in denial. And so she wouldn't let me go to step two or step three. And I was saying, but if I just do these steps, it'll work. But anyway, then her life fell apart. And so, you know, and it was at that time, it was like God was working in my life. Because it was then that I went to this meeting and I heard this woman share, and that's what she talked about. She said, this program is a program. You have to be diligent, and you have to be committed. Well, I was so impressed with what this woman said that when the meeting was over, I chased her down the hall. I finally caught her, and all she said was, I just told her how impressed I was with what she had said. And she said, well, my home group meets on Thursday night at 8 o'clock at such and such a church, and we'd love to have you. Well, I couldn't go that Thursday night, but the following Thursday, I went, and she remembered me. And so, anyway, I went that night, and she gave me a CD to listen to. And I listened to the CD, and the next day I called her, and I asked her, I said, would you consider being my temporary sponsor? Because my sponsor is having some real problems with her life right now and is not able to be a sponsor, and I'm kind of in limbo, so would you be my temporary sponsor? And she said, well, yes, I will do that. And then I said, well, in honesty, I need a full-time sponsor. Will you sponsor me full-time? Because, you know, I think I was feeling her out. Anyway, but she told me, she said, well, she said, we'll pray about it. And she said, let's meet and I will tell you what my requirements are. So we met. And I said, absolutely. And, of course, attending meetings was one of the meetings. Prayer was number one up on that list. Number one, pray. Attend meetings and more meetings. And she said, you call three women every day. Every day you call three women and you commit to four meetings a week. And so by this time I was willing to do it. And so I did. I started calling. I called three women every day, sometimes four. And I would pray every day. And I mean, I really got to work in the program. Now, I didn't have a lot of, by this time now, I knew I was powerless. That situation coming out of St. Mary's drinking on top of all those drugs, that demonstrated to me that I was truly powerless. I was brought up in the church, so I already had my concept of God. I already believed in a higher power. And then this thing of turning my will and my life over to God, I had a little difficulty doing that, but I was willing. By now, I was willing, okay? So this lady worked with me, and I was anxious. By this time, I was really anxious to work the steps. I was ready to give up the drink, and I was ready for my life to change because I could look back and see so much damage that I had done. And so I started working the steps, and I had heard people talk about how they dread it doing the fourth step. They dread it doing the fifth step. Well, I got on through the first three steps. I think she took me through, you know, not too fast, but I mean, she knew I was ready. So I sat down and I did my fourth step, and I wrote down all those people to whom I had resentments. And it was amazing that the people I resented the most were the people I loved the most in my life, the people who could be the closest to me, the people who could hurt me the most. And one of my biggest resentments was my mother. My mother was, that was number one on my list. And I had resented it for years, the fact that my mother had been mentally ill and had never been able to be a mother to me. And And I'd held a lot of this in. I'd never dealt with it. But although in the past I did go to MCV and get some counseling, and that helped. But anyway, but really coming to terms and coming to forgiveness, that was the thing I had not yet done. So when I got to that fourth step, I had my resentments down, but I had my part in it. But my sponsor was wise and pointed out, yes, this was your part, but over here, no, that was not your fault. This was not your fault. So that helped me tremendously, to have someone guide me through this process. Then the fifth step, I admitted to my sponsor. I picked my sponsor as a person to tell, and I had to tell some stuff too. Because when I was drinking, I did things that I would be ashamed. I mean, I think when we're drinking, we all do things that we're ashamed of. And when we start looking back after we get sober, at least for me, I had a lot of remorse. I hurt a lot of people. And I made a lot of people's lives very uncomfortable. And like on vacations, when I'd go with cousins on vacations, these were people who were social drinkers. They could take a drink and have a nice vacation and be at the beach, and what do? I become a slush. And then they've got to take me and put me in the bed, and then I embarrass them, and I go into a restaurant, embarrass my family or whoever I'm with. I did all that kind of stuff. I could think back on some of that stuff, and a lot of it I didn't. I had cousins that would remind me how I ruined their vacation, how I embarrassed them to the point that they wanted to just disappear into the flow. I see some of you looking now like, I mean, I did it. But of course, at that time, we're sick people. But I, doing that fourth and fifth step were very liberating for me. It was very liberating. And then we didn't spend a lot of time on six because I was ready for God to remove my difficulties and my defects of character. I asked him to, okay? And then number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I wanted to do that. And I had a nice long list there. And I was very, very nervous about going to these people and making my amends. But I remember I was at Short Pump at a meeting one day, and a gentleman got up, and I've heard so many people say, people get tired of hearing over and over again, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, I didn't mean to do that. I'm so sorry. Oh, I didn't. You know, they're tired of hearing I'm sorry. They want to see a change. They want to see a different person. So I had to wait. I had to be sober. I had to stay sober a while and let these people see me as a sober person before I wanted to go and make my amends. But it was amazing. Even though I was nervous, when I went to these various people and made my amends, I would tell them what I was doing so forth. They could see a difference. And I would ask them, and now what can I do? What would you like for me to do, or what else can I do to make this up? And you know, and they would say, keep doing what you're doing, stay sober, keep doing your program. And so that's what they would say. They were so glad to see the change. And now there were a couple of amends. The amends I had to make to my mother, my sponsor had me write a letter. And I had to write, I wrote a letter to my brother too, and I had to write a letter to my husband. And I was able to take these letters to the cemetery and put them down in the ground. But it was, they, and so that was a very healing process for me, because I was able to really make some amends that I needed to do. And I did that. I went ahead and did my amends, and then continued to take personal inventory. I try every day. If I'm wrong, I try to admit it. Usually if I know I'm wrong, I'll do that. And then each day I try to pray and continue with prayer and meditation. I don't meditate a whole lot because my mind goes a lot, but I meditate a lot when I'm driving because I'm still thinking. But I still maintain my conscious contact with God every morning before I get out of bed. and every night. And I have found that gratitude helps me so much. Not only do I thank my higher power for my night of rest and for all the blessings I have, but I also ask for guidance. You know, I learned in this program, God is good, orderly direction. All these little things. When I first came in the program, I didn't know anything. I thought the program was for these people that came from under the railroad tracks and the bombs and the less desirable people in society. But I found out it is not that at all. It is not that at all. And I do try to. This program has helped me to focus on maintaining a conscious contact with God on a daily basis. And then, of course, when we get to number 11, I've already done that, but having had a spiritual awakening, we tried to carry the message to the other sick and suffering alcoholics. And I do some volunteer work at St. Mary's Hospital. I take a meeting with two other people up. I greet at my home group meeting and try to be of service by speaking and also talking to people at the meetings when they come in, especially the newcomers. Try to be, you know, help them and encourage them. Just do what I can. It may not be a whole lot, but, you know, I believe sometimes the old saying is, if you can't do great things, do small things in great ways. And I like that little quote. But anyway, this program, I look at this program, for me, it is truly a design for living. I think I've often said that the way our country is now, I think it would help everybody if everybody could live by these principles and these steps, our country, our whole society would benefit. Because to me, it truly is a design for living. And it was through this program that I was able to finally come to a point of forgiveness, to forgive my mother for not being able to be the mother that I had wanted. And I had to forgive the fact that, you know, and realize that she was sick. It was not her fault. And I appreciate so much my father being so loyal. And he was so loyal to me and to my mom, and I was blessed to have such a wonderful father. And even though I lost my family early on in life, I've been blessed with wonderful friends. I've met wonderful people in this program. I mean, and I think it's a wonderful program because, like it says, it's a we program. This is a program that I feel has saved my life. When I was volunteering at that hospital, I was still drinking. You know, I told you, jail didn't stop me. So my physician actually had his nurse call me while I was volunteering there and call me to the phone one day. They had looked at my liver enzymes. And they were so high. And he said, please, please give up the alcohol. Your liver enzymes are way up. And I honestly believe if I had not gotten sober, I'd be dead by now, if not by alcohol, by a car wreck or something. But I mean, I had gotten to the point where I had the shakes, and it's so wonderful. It is so wonderful now that I can go to a Thanksgiving or a Christmas meal and go by the table and pick up a spoon and put food on my plate and go in, and it's not. And I've got to come up with some tall tale like, I've got a slight sinus infection and the medicine makes me a little nervous. I mean, I would come up with anything. I had to make up some excuse. Or standing in a line, you're standing in line at a McDonald's waiting to get yourself a little hamburger or a little whatever, and you're wondering, can anybody around me smell all the booze oozing out? Because I used to worry about that because I know I've had people say, you must have gone to a big party last night. I mean, you can smell it, and it's embarrassing, especially if you're in a nice place. You know, if you're around good people and you're in a social situation, and you know you reek of alcohol. You just reek of it, and you're worried, can they smell me? Can they smell me? And then you're afraid to talk because you know they can smell it on your breath. I mean, all those fears, I don't have to worry about those fears today. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful. And my old friends that kind of just distanced themselves from me, I mean, my good friends who kept saying, you've got a problem, you need to go get help. And actually, I was railroaded into Alcoholics Anonymous in the beginning. But they came back. They've all come back, and they're telling me how proud they are. But I used to say, yeah, I'll go with you to the movies. Yeah. And I would think, well, if I have something to do, a commitment like going to the movies, I won't drink. But by the time it came time to go to the movies, I was drunk and I'd have to call and say, I can't go. And I'd come up with some feeble excuse like, well, I've got an upset stomach. Or, well, I've got a touch of diarrhea and I don't think I better go. I mean, I would come up with every kind of excuse. And it was a lie. It was a lie. Drinking made me become a person that I was not, that I really was not. I was not the person God intended for me to be, and I know that. Because before I started drinking, I was responsible. I may have had fears, and I may have been an overachiever, but I, when I said I was going to do something, I did it. I kept my word. When I was drinking, my word was, it may as well have been sailing out there on a boat somewhere, gone on. It meant nothing. And I couldn't keep a commitment. And I was self-centered and selfish and so forth. But this program has really saved my life. And every time I go to a meeting, I always hear something I need to hear. And I'll tell you this, I want to continue to go to meetings and to be active in the AA program because I have just enough fear. I've heard enough people talk about relapsing. I went through relapse. I've seen enough people with 14 years, 10 years relapse. And when I first saw it, I thought, how could that happen? But it can happen. And most of the time it's because they stopped working the program and they stopped going to meetings. And I want to be smart enough to observe and learn from these other people and to stay close. I know if I stay close to this program and stay on the beam and do what I'm supposed to do, stay close to the program, stay close to my sponsor, and stay close to my higher power. If I do that, my chances of continuing a joyous, happy life as a sober person are greatly enhanced. And again, thank you so much for having me and letting me share a little bit of my story. I could tell you a whole lot more, but you don't want to hear that. I don't think a lot of that, because I think most... all of us, when we were drinking, did things that, you know, we would never do when we were, you know, if we were sober. So, again, thank you so much for having me.